Turn with me to Isaiah chapter 36 and see the relevance to all of that from our text as we take this journey through Isaiah. This is where we resume, Isaiah chapter 36. So the irony is that there's a whole lot going on, that the northern kingdom, the 10 tribes that made up the northern kingdom when Israel was divided into two, they were conquered by the Assyrians. The Assyrians made nations cease to exist. They didn't just, as later the Babylonians would conquer Jerusalem and take all of Jerusalem captives into Babylon, all of the people of Judea. They take them to Babylon, but they didn't destroy them as a people. They kept them together, they retained their identity, and again returned, a remnant returned. In the same way, the whole human race was reduced to just a few survivors in the days of Noah. So it was with the nation of Israel, a number of times. This is relevant, that God did in fact preserve the, and it's truly amazing that somebody like Joel Kramer can show you the archaeology, can actually show you, the, as you just saw pictures, of Hezekiah's wall, the wall that Hezekiah built as Jerusalem expanded, receiving all of these refugees from the northern kingdom. Isaiah chapter 36, verse 1. Now it came to pass in the 14th year of King Hezekiah that Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came up against all the defense cities of Judah and took them. Now let me pause there and just point out to you that Joel actually showed that column of Assyrian writing, and that's actually in the British Museum, and it includes what we just read, the boasting of Sennacherib that he did in fact take these fortified walled cities of 46 of them, of Judah. What somebody like Sennacherib will do in history is only mention the pluses and don't mention any of the minors or minuses. So yeah, okay, you took all those fortified cities, but you didn't take the capital of Judea, of Judah. You did not take the capital, and he certainly does not boast that he did. As a matter of fact, he omits that he lost 185,000 soldiers. And that he boasts that he took Hezekiah's fortified cities leading up to Jerusalem. Verse 2 says, the king of Assyria sent Rabshakeh from Lachish to Jerusalem unto King Hezekiah. And by the way, Lachish is mentioned in the list, significant in the archaeology of what is there in the British Museum. And from Lachish to Jerusalem unto King Hezekiah with a great army. A great army. We will learn the number of that great army. And he stood by the conduit of the upper pool in the highway of the fuller's field. So this guy, Rabshakeh, and by the way, that's not so much a name as it is a title. Rabshakeh, he's the Rabshakeh. In fact, I think that's how the English Standard Version translates it. The Rabshakeh came. So it's a title, kind of like trusted, it kind of became field commander, but originally it was more like, you know, butler, wine taster, but it turned into, over time, field commander. So he's the Rabshakeh. And he comes right into the very public place, the water source for Jerusalem. In verse 3, then came forth unto him Eliakim, Hilkiah's son, which is over the house, and Shebna the scribe, and Joah, Asaph's son, the recorder. And Rabshakeh said unto them, say ye unto Hezekiah, thus saith the great king, the king of Assyria, what confidence is this wherein you thou trustest? I say, sayest thou, but they are vain words, I have counsel and strength for war. Now on whom dost thou trust that thou rebellest against me? Lo, thou trustest in the staff of this broken reed, on Egypt, whereon if a man lead, it will go into his hand and pierce it. So is Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to all that trust in him. you of course will remember, that there, some of the princes of Judah at this time wanted to make a deal. They sent messengers and camels and caravans trying to buy an alliance with the Egyptians as if, you know, they should ever look to man, they should ever look to Egypt. Hezekiah, he chose rather to trust the Lord. But this guy, the Rabshakeh, he's got good intel. He has his sources, probably has his spies, you know, inside Jerusalem, probably even inside Hezekiah's very palace. So he knows that Egypt has been consulted. In verse 7, but if thou say to me, you would trust in the Lord. That is actually, you see, it's all capitalized, L-O-R-D. That represents Yahweh, the name. So if you say to me, we trust in Yahweh, our God, our Elohim, is it not he whose high places and whose altars Hezekiah hath taken away? So he's got good sources of information. He knows that Hezekiah has implemented these reforms, and he has, in fact, destroyed altars and high places, but they were pagan. So he's not totally informed. He has his intel, but it falls way short. So is it not he whose high places and whose altars Hezekiah hath taken away and said to Judah and Jerusalem, you shall worship before this altar? Now therefore give pledges, I pray thee, to my master the king of Assyria, and I will give thee 2,000 horses, if thou be able to, on thy part, to set riders on them. You can't even muster a cavalry, even if I give you the horses, even if I give you 2,000, even if you had that. Verse 9, how then wilt thou turn away the face of one captain of the least of my master's servants and put thy trust on Egypt for chariots and for horsemen? And am I now come up without the Lord against this land to destroy it? The Lord, your Yahweh, said unto me, go up against this land and destroy it. He is assuming much, and he's assuming, as he does know, there were prophecies against the northern kingdom. Those prophecies were fulfilled when the northern kingdom fell to the Assyrians. He's assuming much. And so now he's even acting like he's got a connection with Yahweh, and it was Yahweh that told him, go up against this land and destroy. Verse 11. Then said Eliakim and Shebna and Joah unto Rabshakeh, speak, I pray thee, unto thy servants in the Syrian language. They wanted this in Aramaic, so the public wouldn't hear it. For we understand it, and speak not to us in the Jews' language, in the ears of the people that are on the wall. But Rabshakeh said, have my master sent me to thy master and to thee to speak these words? Have he not sent me to the men that sit upon the wall, that they may eat their own dung and drink their own piss with you? King James Version, that's an old English word, in case you didn't know it. So that's the conditions of a people under siege, when all food and all supplies are cut off. Desperate, desperate measures end up being taken, and including that. Verse 13, the Rabshakeh stood and cried with a loud voice in the Jews' language and said, hear ye the words of the king of Assyria. Thus saith the king, let not Hezekiah deceive you, for he shall not be able to deliver you. Neither let Hezekiah make you trust in the Lord, that is, in Yahweh, saying, Yahweh, the Lord, will deliver us. This city shall not be delivered into the hand of the king of Assyria. Well, hearken not to Hezekiah, for thus saith the king of Assyria, make an agreement with me, and buy a present, and come out to me, eat every one of his vine, and every one of his fig tree, and drink ye every one of the waters of his own cistern, until I come and take you away to a land like your own land, a land of corn and wine, a land of bread and vineyards. So you don't have to die. You don't have to experience this dreadful siege and the cannibalism and all those other awful things that will happen. Listen, just come out, surrender. You're going to go back to your own house. Drink of your own cistern, out of your own well. Eat out of your own field until I come, and then we're going to remove you. We'll take you to another place, a land like your own land. land of bread and vineyards. Verse 18, beware lest Hezekiah persuade you, saying, the Lord will deliver us. Watch out for that. Now, hath any of the gods of the nations delivered his land out of the hand of the king of Assyria? Where are the gods of Hamath and Arphad? Where are the gods of Sepharvaim? And have they delivered Samaria out of my hand? Who are they among all the gods of these lands that have delivered their land out of my hand, that the Lord, that Yahweh, should deliver Jerusalem out of my hand? But they held their peace and answered him not a word, for the king's commandment was, saying, answer him not. And then came Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, that was over the household, and Shebna the scribe, and Joah the son of Asaph, the recorder, to Hezekiah with their clothes rent, and told him the words of Rabshakeh. So they came extremely distressed, and they communicated their great distress, tearing their own clothes. And it came to pass, when King Hezekiah heard it, that he rent his clothes and covered himself with sackcloth and went into the house of the Lord. He went to the right place. He did the right thing. Hezekiah is one of the good kings. He sent Eliakim, who was over the household, and Shebna the scribe, and the elders of the priests, covered with sackcloth, unto Isaiah the prophet, the son of Amos. They said unto him, thus saith Hezekiah, this is a day of trouble and of rebuke and of blasphemy, for the children are come to birth, and there's not strength to bring forth. And maybe the Lord thy God will hear the words of Rabshakeh, whom the king of Assyria, his master, hath sent to reproach the living God, and will reprove the words which the Lord thy God hath heard. Wherefore lift up thy prayer for the remnant that is left. So they were sent from Hezekiah to ask Isaiah, please pray. Maybe God will take sides on this. So the servant of King Hezekiah came to Isaiah, and Isaiah said unto them, thus shall you say unto your master, thus saith the Lord, be not afraid of the words that thou hast heard, wherewith the servants of the king of Assyria have blasphemed me. Pause. Let me just remind you, you hear the words from Isaiah, go tell the king, be not afraid of the words. Well, outside the walls of Jerusalem is the mightiest army on earth that has never been defeated. And he is being told by the prophet Isaiah, trust me, God is saying, I got this. They blaspheme me. Verse 7, behold, I'll send a blast upon him. He shall hear a rumor and return to his own land, and I will cause him to fall by the sword in his own land. God sends a message through the prophet informing him he's going to take care of this. So Rabshakeh returned and found the king of Assyria warring against Libna, for he had heard that he was departed from Lachish, and he heard say concerning Tirhakah, king of Ethiopia, he has come forth to make war with thee. And when he heard it, he sent messengers to Hezekiah, saying, thus shall you speak to Hezekiah, the king of Judah, saying, let not thy God in whom thou trustest deceive thee, saying, Jerusalem shall not be given into the hand of the king of Assyria. Behold, thou hast heard what the kings of Assyria have done to all lands by destroying them utterly, and shalt thou be delivered? Have the gods of the nations delivered them which my fathers have destroyed, as Gozan and Haran and Rezeph and the children of Eden which were in Telassar? Where is the king of Hamath and the king of Arphad and the king of the city of Sepharvaim, Hina and Iva? And Hezekiah received the message, the letter from the hand of the messengers and read it. And Hezekiah went into the house of the Lord and spread it before the Lord. This is the coolest move of all the kings, to get a piece of mail like that and go, oh, Lord, this is for you. Just pass it on, spreads it out, and they sent it to me, but it was to you. Well, Hezekiah prayed unto the Lord, verse 15 says. He prayed this, saying, O Lord of hosts, the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, that dwelleth between the cherubims. Thou art the God, even thou alone, all the kingdoms of the earth. Thou hast made heaven and earth. Well, that's a good way to, that's a good place to start. Just remind God of who he is. Do yourself a big favor. Remind God of who he is and hear yourself doing it. Incline thine ear, O Lord, and hear. Open thine eyes, and O Lord, and see and hear all the words of Sennacherib, which he hath sent to reproach the living God. I don't know about you guys. I find myself doing this going, Lord, you hear what they're saying. You hear what they're saying. You know the arrogance of their thought. Show them their irrelevance. I pray that stuff all the time. I tell the Lord what I know he knows. Verse 18, of a truth, Lord, of a truth, the kings of Assyria have laid waste all the nations and their countries, and they have cast their gods into the fire, for they were no gods, but the work of men's hands, woods, stone. Therefore, they have destroyed them. Now, therefore, O Lord, our God, save us from his hand, that all the kingdoms of the earth may know that thou art the Lord, even thou only. That's a good prayer, Lord. Show them. Show them they don't know what they're talking about. They don't know who you are. Right? Do this, God, for the sake of your name in this world, that all the nations will know who you are. And then Isaiah, the son of Amos, sent unto Hezekiah, saying, thus saith the Lord God of Israel, whereas thou hast prayed to me against Sennacherib, king of Assyria, this is the word which the Lord hath spoken concerning him. The virgin, the daughter of Zion, hath despised thee and laughed thee to scorn. The daughter of Jerusalem hath shaken her head at thee. Whom hast thou reproached and blasphemed? And against whom hast thou exalted thy voice and lifted up thy eyes on high, even against the Holy One of Israel? This is a message that Isaiah tells Hezekiah to send back to this pagan king. Just tell him, who do you think you are? And who do you think Yahweh is? Who do you think you're trash talking? Verse 24, by thy servant hast thou reproached the Lord. That's again, all capitals. You have reproached Yahweh. And said, by the multitude of my chariots am I come up to the height of the mountains, to the sides of Lebanon. I will cut down the tall cedars thereof and the choice fir trees thereof. And I will enter into the height of his border and the forest of his Carmel. I have digged and drunk waters, and with the sole of my feet have I dried up all the rivers of the besieged places. Hast thou not heard long ago how I have done it, and of ancient times that I have performed it? Now have I brought it to pass that thou shouldest be to lay waste cities, defensed cities, and to ruinous heaps. Their inhabitants were of small power. They were dismayed and confounded. They were as the grass of the field and as the green herb and as the grass of the housetops, as the corn blasted before it be grown up. Just a piece of, trivia, but information. Our English Bible uses the word corn, and yet this old English Bible means wheat. Corn was unknown to the people of Israel. Corn was unknown to Europe. Corn was unknown to the entire continents of Europe and Asia, Africa, until Columbus made the connection. Corn was developed here in North America. Believe it or not, plant husbandry, genetic engineering, crossbreeding, and the natives of North America produce corn. But anyway, the Old English Bible uses the word corn all the way through it. It's a reference to wheat. Back to the subject, verse 28. I don't know if anybody cares about what I just said. But I know it. I just seemed like I got to make it be known, just for the record. I just don't want you to picture a bunch of corn shucking Hebrews. It's wheat. Verse 28. But I know thy abode, and thy going out, and thy coming in. And thy rage against me, because thy rage against me and thy tumult is come up into mine ears. Therefore will I put my hook in thy nose. Ouch. And that's kind of a big deal to the Assyrians. They were brutal people, and they were also a seafaring people, and they did as they took captives away to their capital of Nineveh, draw them away with hooks in the jaws, hooks in the nose. They were brutal people. They'd leave behind pyramids of heads that would, you know, just decay to skulls. They had mastered brutality, and they had the whole world afraid. And the Lord said, I'm going to put a hook in your nose and my bridle in thy lips. I will turn thee back by the way which thou camest. And this shall be a sign unto thee. You shall eat this year such as groweth of itself. This sign, by the way, this is not to Sennacherib. This is where the message ends. This is Isaiah now saying to Hezekiah, to the people, you need a sign? Trust me. You shall eat this year such as groweth of itself, and the second year that which springeth of the same, and the third year sow ye and reap, and plant vineyards, and eat the fruit thereof. And the remnant that is escaped of the house of Judah shall take root downward and bear fruit upward. For out of Jerusalem shall go forth a remnant, and they that escape out of Mount Zion, the zeal of the Lord of hosts shall do this. Therefore, thus saith the Lord. And I love it when the Lord does that. The zeal of the Lord. This is God talking. And I'm motivated. This is the zeal of the Lord of hosts to perform this. Well, verse 33. Therefore, thus saith the Lord concerning the king of Assyria. He shall not come into this city, nor shoot an arrow there, nor come before it with shields, nor cast a bank against it. By the way that he came, by the same shall he return. Shall not come into the city, saith the Lord. For that to happen, something very miraculous is going to have to happen. For I will, verse 35, I will defend this city to save it for mine own sake and for my servant David's sake. My own sake. My servant David's sake. The angel of the Lord went forth and smote. This is it. Like this one verse gets this whole story told. I want more details, Lord. I'll get them later. I'll get them with him. I'm like, what did that look like? Can I see it? Show me. What did the angel look like? How did he do it? Did he just wave a great sword? Or did he just walk through and just collect all their breath? You know, I don't know. I'm going to know. I want to see it. The angel of the Lord went forth and smote. How did he? Did he smite? Did he smite? Did he actually just go right through? Just line them all up? He smote in the camp of the Assyrians 185,000. And when they arose early in the morning, not they who were smote, but the people of Israel, people of Judah, the citizens of Jerusalem, when they arose early in the morning, behold, there were all dead corpses. So Sennacherib, king of Assyria, departed. He was spared. So Sennacherib departed. That's the proper thing to do when you've got the mightiest army on earth and they're all dead. And the fight didn't even start yet. They're in Jerusalem. Yeah, you need to find somewhere else to be. And go write your great achievements, which is what he did. So Sennacherib, king of Assyria, departed, went and returned, and dwelt in Nineveh. It came to pass, as he was worshiping, that doesn't mean immediately, because he had time to you know, write his memoirs, chronicle his great achievements, those 46 fortified cities of, you know, Judah that he took, conquered, omitting how it all ended, none of that's written. It came to pass as he was worshiping in the house of Nishuk, his god, that Adramelech and Sharezer, his son, smote him with a sword, and they escaped into the land of Armenia. And Esarhaddon, his son, reigned in his stead. So let me tonight again refer you back to the other whole part of the story not given to us here in Isaiah. What the scriptures tell us about all of the refugees, that God made promises that included all the 12 tribes. Foolish people who write things about 10 lost tribes really don't give God a whole lot of credit. Like, God loses tribes. He doesn't lose individuals, let alone tribes. As if there's anything anywhere that God doesn't know where it is. Nothing's lost to him. But there's a lot of stuff going on. As a matter of fact, I don't know if you guys know this, but the Mormons' founder, Joe Smith, treasure hunter, con man, you know, storyteller from upstate New York, from Palmyra. He claimed that those 10 lost tribes built great ships and sailed across the Atlantic and inhabited North America. And that's who the natives of the land were. When our pilgrim founders and others came, those were the 10 lost tribes. That is the most ridiculous, stupid fairy tale. And the thing about Joe Smith, it's kind of like a lot of criminals today that, a lot of criminals a couple decades ago who did things and left DNA behind, unaware that eventually the technology would catch up and the evidence of their crime would be analyzed and their identity found. You guys have surely heard about all those cases. Sometimes men are set free, falsely accused. They were in prison. And the actual criminal has been caught in its DNA. I watched a story of a 50-year-old cold case from a girl dying on a Girl Scout camp in Colorado 50 years later, because they had evidence. They had the DNA of that killer under the nails of that girl. And with that DNA, they were able to narrow it down to her. It was actually a member of her own family. It was a cousin. It's kind of like that with liars like Joe Smith. Joe Smith had no idea that archaeology would really advance, and genetics also. In fact, one of the really shocking things is because Joe's lying, Joseph Smith's crazy storytelling, there were a lot of people from Mormon universities that entered the field, the various fields of genetics, wanting to study genetics for the sake of, like some Christian might, wanting to actually find verification of biblical truth in that field of science. And there are documentaries available of those Mormons who became Christians, who abandoned Mormonism after discovering that genetics disproves every single silly thing that Joe wrote. Joe Smith wanted to just write stuff that sounded like Bible. He wasn't counting on the advancement of science would happen. By the way, in case you're curious about what is the response of the spiritual leaders and elders of the LDS church, well, with regard to scientific evidence, with regard to archaeology that completely destroys all of the stories of Joe Smith from upstate New York and great wars that were supposedly fought, and with regard to all of the DNA and genetic research that proves that the natives of both North and South America are, in fact, Asians. They crossed the land bridge up in Alaska, Bering Strait, during the Ice Age, when so much water was tied up in massive glaciers on our continents, on the northern parts of those continents. You could actually walk across from Asia to North America. By the way, you guys know that? Did you know that underneath the English Channel, underwater, on the bottom of the English Channel, are the archaeological remains of villages that used to be there during that period of time when so much water was tied up in ice and snow? sea levels rose significantly as the world warmed. This is all centuries after the worldwide flood. But they're all, anyway, so the answer of the LDS elders with regard to genetics not verifying the claim that the 10 lost tribes were the natives of North America, well, the LDS elders have this blanket cop-out that is so profoundly stupid, I can't believe anyone would ever accept it. But their answer is, God has deliberately removed all the scientific evidence to make it a matter of faith. God has actually removed all the archaeology to require it to be a matter of faith. No, it's a matter of stupidity, not faith. Contrast that. In fact, I would encourage you, as I earlier mentioned, Expedition Bible, and one of the best episodes of Expedition Bible is Joe Kramer shares with a Mormon friend that he's met there in Israel. And just says, can we just talk about your prophet versus the biblical prophets? And that, all of those documentaries that Joel has done, most of them are fairly short, like that one which we just watched, which is only 10 minutes, 10 and a half, and they're like that. But that one with his Mormon friend was profound, truly profound. Every single time we read these things, we read what Isaiah has told us. First and Second Kings both tell us all of these things. We read the history in the Old Testament given to us, and it's given in great detail. And what do we find? We find everything that we have just read, including this invasion of Assyria and how it abruptly stopped short. It didn't stop short anywhere else. Every other kingdom the Assyrians conquered, they destroyed, especially the capital of that kingdom. One nation whose capital was left intact by the Assyrians. Only one. That's a matter of historical, verifiable archaeological record. It's written. The secular records also agree, also bear out the truth of the scripture. And when you go to Jerusalem, you can actually visit, you know, the remnant of the wall. And that's the beautiful thing about Jerusalem. You know, the city gets conquered, and they knock all the walls down, level things out. And they go, you know, this is a great spot for a city. We got to rebuild, and they rebuild another layer. And it just keeps getting a little taller. And in Jerusalem, you can be a homeowner in Jerusalem and go digging for, you know, gas line, sewer line, and discover there's another house under your house. It's actually intact. You just go down there and get the dirt out of the way. There are a number of places in Jerusalem where the homeowner goes, well, I guess I'm just going to open up a museum. And the archaeologists come in and do their part, and they'll run wire to put lights, and you've got several floors of history, several periods of time. Absolutely amazing. Truly it is. Again, just the point I wanted to make is just that this book, we have all kinds of, you know, God is not some kind of joker who goes, well, I'm just going to remove all the evidence. So you just have to believe, just trust. God is a faith, biblical, the call to faith in the scriptures is not a call to irrationality. It's reasonable. It is a reasonable thing. You guys know what I'm saying to you? It is a reasonable thing for the God of the Bible to call us to believe in him. He goes about strengthening our faith, verifying our faith. I actually believe, as I have said, quoting it, in fact, I think it was this morning in staff meeting, Romans 10:17, faith comes by hearing and hearing by the word of God. I don't think archaeology is going to make anybody come to faith. I don't think any of the sciences by themselves will make anybody come to faith. It's the word of God. It's hearing the word that does. But at the same time, our faith should be, if it's like I've been saying on Sunday mornings as we're going through, you know, the Noahic flood, if such a massive event as what is described in Genesis 6 through 9 happened, we jolly well ought to see evidence of it, huh? And indeed we do everywhere. It was a worldwide catastrophe. How does something like that happen and leave no trace? No, there's plenty of trace. But again, you know, what people do with the evidence. What do people do? We have all of the sedimentary layers, rather uniform, all around the continents. Sedimentary layers are what both the secular geologist and the creationist geologist call mega sequences. Six mega sequences. But the secularist says, no, this represents an age. This layer of the stratification represents an age. It took millions of years to build this up. And this is an ecosystem. No, that's just the first stuff that got killed. And it got buried. Really. And this stuff up here, that's the last stuff, because they could run. That's really that simple. Profound. I don't know if you guys are aware of this. Back when I was a teen, some of you guys were as well, 1980, the eruption of Mount St. Helens provided all kinds of observable geological phenomenon, and they claimed that all of these sedimentary layers, like the ones at the Grand Canyon, represent millions of years. And then the canyon itself, a little bit of water and a lot of time just kept carving and carving. No. Actually, a lot of water in a little time. There is a miniature version of what the secular geologists say takes millions of years to develop. They actually call it the mini Grand Canyon. In the lower regions below Mount St. Helens, it was all produced by the eruption. And all of the stratification was laid down in a matter of hours. All of the sedimentary layers were produced in a matter of hours. And then the canyon itself, washing out and exposing all that sedimentary layer, just like the Grand Canyon, happened in a few days. Layers laid down in hours, and a canyon carved in a few days, out of rock. Anyway, so it is. I just thought I'd take advantage of this journey tonight, connected to what we're doing on Sundays, and just point out to you that everything that we are reading right here is verified in the archaeology in Jerusalem and in the archaeology in Assyria, in Nineveh. Andrew, you got a song. Once you get geared up, and I'll finish my remarks. If you guys here not followed the Lord in baptism, we're going to do that this Sunday night, in case nobody told you. This Sunday evening, baptisms. It's a good time to put a mark on your own life story's timeline. Put a landmark down. Where you identified yourself as being dead, buried, and raised with Christ. Let's all stand together. Come on, you guys, let's stand. If you guys need prayer, elders who are present, would you guys come on up and be available for just a little while, a few minutes after the service? Come now. And if your wife is with you, bring her and be available. You got things going on, you might want somebody to pray with you, pray for you. Give us a chance to do that. But by all means, take advantage of the opportunity to fellowship. Let's go out of here singing.